Hey guys, welcome back. We are so excited because today we get to interview the Nancy Piercy. Professor Piercy is the author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes, as well as Love Thy Body, The Soul of Science, Saving Leonardo, Finding Truth, and Total Truth. She is a professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. She has been quoted in The New Yorker and Newsweek, highlighted as one of the five top women apologists by Christianity Today, and hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. So we are so excited we get to talk to her. I'm Kenna Rose, and with me is
Jenna Smith.
Nancy, thank you so much for coming on. I can't tell you how excited we are to get to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's really good to see you guys again.
I know you came and spoke at IFI's Worldview Conference this past, I think it was March. Your speech was so good. I know my family and I are still pulling things out from it, being like, remember when Nancy Piercy said this? We need to use this. So thank you so much. I know we are so grateful for you.
No, thank you. Appreciate that.
We thought we would start out with some fun questions. But what books or pieces of advice have shaped your life that, I don't know, I guess you're really grateful for?
That and how that can kind of relate to Generation Z, because as a younger generation, we're looking for things to inspire us and keep us grounded.
You know, when I was reading your questions, I think one of your questions was what book has inspired you the most. And so I'd like to answer this question with the book. I became a Christian through the work of Francis Schaeffer. And he's not as well known anymore, but he influenced a whole generation of young people to become Christians. He had a sort of study center in Switzerland. And I had lived in Germany when I was a child, and I liked it so much that I saved up all my money through high school so I could go back. And you will appreciate this. I saved my money from my high school job, which was playing the violin in the El Paso Symphony Orchestra. We lived right outside of El Paso. And so, yeah, I was able to go back to Germany by saving up my money from playing the violin. But while I was in Europe, I did sort of stumble across Francis Schaeffer's ministry in Switzerland. And I was not a Christian at the time. I was blown away by the apologetics. I had no idea that Christianity could be defended with good reasons and arguments, and that it could stand, you know, hold its own against the secular isms of the day.
Yeah.
And I was so surprised. I had never had any exposure to apologetics, you know, to the idea that you could defend Christianity. And so it took a year and a half. I was pretty stubborn. I didn't want Christianity to be true. But I did become a Christian eventually through the apologetics of Francis Schaeffer. And so I do encourage people to keep reading his stuff. You asked me a question about C.S. Lewis, too, in your questions. And Lewis and Schaeffer, this is what I tell my students. Lewis and Schaeffer were the two top apologists of the 20th century in terms of the sheer number of people who either converted or were brought through a crisis of faith through their work. And so I tell my students, just read them first. You know, before you read anyone else, just read Lewis and Schaeffer, because they were so successful. We should learn from success. Mm. You know, why is it more people converted through their writings than any other? And here's what I say to them. Don't read their writings for information. Read their writings until you think like them. You absorb their thinking and can think like them. Those are the two people I would suggest for young people today, to just absorb it. Read it multiple times. Absorb their thinking. Absorb their arguments. And until you can reproduce it yourself, until you can talk about it, you know, on the tip of your tongue.
That is amazing. And so that kind of does answer our question about C.S. Lewis, because we were going to ask, like, why is it important to read his works? And you just answered, it's because of the way that they think and of the way they present the gospel. It is one of the most convincing ways that you can be able to present the gospel accurately and convincingly. I know Kenna was going to ask something about one of your talks at the Worldview Conference.
So I remember you talking about there being good news, but also surprising news, just because most people don't think about it in terms of Christianity. And it had to do with most people often accuse evangelical Christian men of being oppressive patriarchs prone to abuse. But you were talking about how that's not really the case. And we would love to hear you explain.
Yeah, because you're right. If anything, evangelical Christian men are considered exhibit A of toxic masculinity. But as a result, they've been studied. there have been sociological and psychological studies of Christian men, which is wonderful. You know, if they hadn't been targeted, maybe they wouldn't have been studied. I sort of stumbled across this data when I was writing my book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, and I suddenly realized I'd found the answer. You know, my book was looking at where did the concept of toxicity even come from, and then how do we respond to it? And suddenly the response was right in front of me. It was all these studies that were actually done of Christian men. It's an empirical question. The accusation was, if you believe in any sort of male headship in the home, that will turn you into an overbearing, tyrannical, oppressive patriarch. Well, that's an empirical claim. So the social scientists said, well, does it? Does it in fact turn men into overbearing patriarchs? And what they said is, where's your evidence? Where's your data? So they went out and they did the studies. And in my book, I quote some dozen or so different studies. And they all found, as you said, surprisingly, Christian men, evangelical men, do test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. Well, the first question I always get is, well, what about their wives? Did they agree with that? So yes, they did interview the wives separately. And the wives test out as being the happiest with their husband's treatment of them. Evangelical fathers spend more time with their children than anybody else, 3.5 hours more per week than secular men. Evangelical couples are less likely to divorce, 35% less likely to divorce than secular couples, 35%. And they have actually the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any group in America. And sometimes a quote can crystallize it. So let me give you a quotation. The sociologist who did the largest study is Brad Wilcox at the University of Virginia. To give you a sense of his stature, he gets published in places like the New York Times. So this is actually a quote from a New York Times article that he wrote. It turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives. Fully 73% of women who hold conservative gender values and attend church regularly with their husbands have high quality marriages. So, and of course, the reason they focus on the women, the wives, is that the assumption is that these marriages are abusive to the wives. And so they, no, actually, these are the happiest of all wives in America. That's an amazing finding. This is not a pep talk from some religious leader. This is solid empirical research. These are evidence-based findings that we should be confident in bringing, you know, both into the churches, because it's not there yet, and also into the public square to help debunk the secular narrative about Christian men.
100%. That's so encouraging too. And it goes against what you hear really often. And so it's just encouraging to see that, yeah, what God wrote about in scriptures and the way he says things work, works.
I know, that's exactly the message, isn't it? Is that if you do follow biblical principles, you will have a happier marriage and a healthier family. And it does, in fact, work. And when I say it's not in the churches yet, let me give you an example. I have a graduate student who was the head of the women's ministry at a very large Baptist church here in Houston. And she said, on Mother's Day, we hand out flowers and tell women they're wonderful. On Father's Day, we scold the men and tell them to do better. So the lesson from all this sociological research is stop the scolding and bring this data into the churches where we can encourage and affirm and support the men who are doing well. They really need that today with the incredible attacks on masculinity in our day. You know, Christian men feel it too. When I told my class I was writing a book on masculinity, a male student shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us." You know, even Christian men feel this way. So it's very important to get this into the churches.
It also kind of answered our question, which was, how can churches be more effective to encourage the men in their congregations?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize the data from the social scientists turned up that there are two different groups of Christian men. This was mm-hmm. kind of surprising as well, because the first pushback I always get is, but haven't we all heard that Christian couples divorce at the same rate as the rest of the culture? When I speak to Christian leaders, they often say, well, yeah, I've used that. I've used that statistic, you know, apparently trying to motivate us. Well, so the researchers went back to the data and they made a very important distinction between men who are actually committed, church-going, you know, authentic Christians who are really living it out, like you said, Kenna, you know, you're really living out God's way, God's design for marriage and family. They divided them out from merely nominal Christian men. And that means men who maybe have a Christian background, a family background, they grew up in the church, but now they attend church rarely, if at all. My students don't even know what the word nominal means, so I have to explain. N-O-M is Latin for name, so it means in name only. And these men test out dramatically different. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness. Aww. They spend the least amount of time with their children. They divorce at a higher rate even than secular couples, 20% higher. And they test out as having the highest rates of domestic abuse and violence, higher than secular men. Mm-hmm. To quote Brad Wilcox again, the sociologist, he wrote an article in Christianity Today in which he said, the most violent husbands in America are nominal evangelical Protestant men. So this is really the challenge to the church. To answer your question, Jenna, how can we on the one hand really encourage the men who are doing well, show them that the data is there, it's objective data, they're doing very well, they should know that. And on the other hand, how do we reach out to these men who are at the fringes, who are claiming an evangelical identity, but who are not living it out, and who are in fact, what they're doing is they're taking words like headship and submission and infusing them with meanings, with definitions from the secular script for masculinity. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're giving sort of a Christian veneer to what are really secular ideas. And so we need to figure out how to disciple these men. You know, churches have to think, how can we have a better discipleship program for these men who are at the fringes and who you might say are in a sense ruining the reputation of evangelicals? People who are meeting these men who are saying, oh, evangelical men are so abusive. Well, that's because those are the ones they met, probably, is the nominal.
That is very fair. I remember my dad telling me a story that he used to be somebody that was raised in Christianity but never accepted it quite for his own. And when he was married, an elder at the church his mother was attending invited him to come and help him, you know, take care of the offerings after church and help him like stay accountable with the money. And so my dad started helping out every week. He had to be at church so he can help with the offerings. And through this, the deacon tricked him into attending church regularly and he became a Christian.
That's what a great story.
What I was wondering is your book about toxic war against masculinity,
which is available on Amazon.
Yes, exactly. You say that men are being torn between two competing scripts for masculinity. So can you explain what those are for us?
Yeah, that's a great question because it turns out this grew out of a sociological study as well. And I ended up putting it at the front of the book. And here's why. This has been the most controversial book I've written. I did not expect that. You know, I wrote an earlier book called Love Thy Body on issues of abortion, homosexuality, transgenderism. I really thought that would be the most controversial. But masculinity is a bigger trigger word, it turns out. By the way, here's how it went. I usually do a lot of reading groups, right, to rub off the rough edges, you know, to run the manuscript through lots and lots of people. If you're ever writing a book, it's a great exercise. But what would happen in my reading groups is they would tell their friends and family, you know, we're going through a manuscript on masculinity. And invariably, the first question was, whose side is she on? With that oppositional tone.
Really?
Whose side is she on? Like you, as if you had to take sides. And by the way, men tended to assume that a woman writing a book on masculinity would be a male-bashing feminist. Oh, and they were very defensive. And more progressive types tended to think, well, I'm probably one of those red pill types, you know, that's defending the sort of super masculine, you know, the view of masculinity coming out of the manosphere today. Mm-hmm. And that's why I put this study at the beginning. It tended to help diffuse that. So this study on the two scripts that you mentioned earlier, sociologist is so successful that he speaks all around the world. And so he came up with a very clever experiment. He started asking young men two questions. First, he would ask them, what does it mean to be a good man? You know, if you're at a funeral, for example, and so somebody says he was a good man, what does that mean? All around the globe, young men had no trouble answering that. They would immediately start listing things like honor, duty, integrity, sacrifice, do the right thing, look out for the little guy, be responsible, be a protector, be a provider. And he would say, well, where'd you learn that? And the men would say, I don't know, it's just in the air we breathe. Or I would say, they're made in God's image. And they do have this intrinsic, inherent knowledge of what it means to be a good man, that their unique masculine strengths were not given them just to get whatever they want, but to provide, yeah, protect, care for those that they love. But then he would follow up. The sociologist would ask a second question. He would say, what does it mean to you if I say, man up, be a real man? And the young men themselves would say, oh, no, that's completely different. No, that means be tough, never show weakness, win at all costs, suck it up, play through pain, be competitive, get rich, get laid. I'm using their language. And so the sociologist, he's not a Christian, but he's concluded that men do seem to be torn between these two scripts, that they do have this inherent knowledge of what it means to be the good man. And by the way, that gives us a much better strategy for dealing with these issues, because men don't respond very well to being called toxic. Nobody would. So instead, right, we can try to tap into that inherent sense of the good man. We can be confident it's there because they're made in God's image. We can be confident that they do have an intrinsic sense of what it means to be a man made in God's image. But we also then need to realize that they're kind of being torn by this secular script. It's not all bad. We want people to be tough in a crisis. But a lot of it, when it's disconnected from a moral vision, can slide into being what we now call toxic. The Andrew Tate phenomenon with the hypermasculinity, yeah, I think is the word you used a minute ago. People reading the book realize, okay, good. We can be in favor of one kind of masculinity. But, you can think critically about the other script for masculinity. And that kind of diffused whose side are you on? No, we're not on one side or the other. We are able to see that there's two competing scripts, and we can help people to live out the biblical script.
It makes a lot of sense. And I bet it was encouraging to a lot of people, even who didn't realize it. They're probably just so used to hearing it get bashed or getting bashed. So
I'll throw in some more data while we're at it, because it's also encouraging. Because it was another global study, but this time by an anthropologist. And it was the first ever cross-cultural study of concepts of masculinity. His conclusion was rather similar. He said, there are differences, of course, in expectations on men in different cultures, but there's a common core. There's a common core that all cultures hold of, again, what it means to be the good man. And he put it in this way. He said, it's the three P's: provide, protect, and procreate. In other words, become a father. Or if you don't have children, build into the next generation. So provide, protect, procreate, build. And he said, this is universal. And I thought, there you are. Again, for those people who are just bashing masculinity, the sociological, anthropological data is showing that men do have that intrinsic sense of the good man. And so there's something there we can build on, something we can tap into in order to have a much more positive approach.
That makes a lot of sense. And it kind of ties into another one of the questions that we had, which is, how do we as Christians disprove that, it's not Western civilization who constructed or made up the idea that there are only two sexes? And what you're saying is, it's innate in us who God wants us to be. It's all over the place. It's all over the world.
In my book, again, I put something in the first chapter. It sort of diffuses questions. I said, let's start with biology, okay? If you don't like gender roles and, those kind of discussions, just start with biology, because men are bigger, stronger, faster. They have 75% greater muscle mass, upper body muscle. They have 90% greater upper body strength. And I just looked this one up. 162% greater punching power. But because of testosterone, men are, on average, more aggressive and more risk-taking. And these are just the givens. These are the basic givens of creation. This is how God made men. And that you can't argue with the way God made men. You have to find ways to express it in a biblical way. But you can't argue with the basic facts. And, of course, one reason that women in particular are hesitant to acknowledge differences, right? I mean, I have actually heard feminists say, women could be just as strong as men if they would just work out. No, I'm sorry. It's not biologically possible. By the way, the weakest man has a stronger punch than the strongest woman. I read that just today. Wow. But the reason they're concerned about that is because as soon as you say there are differences, people tend to say, and which one's better? Right? There's going to be one that's better than. Yeah. And so I think in the same breath, we have to be really careful to say that the distinctives about being a woman are strengths. You know, they are strengths. They're physically weaker, but they have the superpower of giving life. And that entails a whole host of psychological strengths as well, because taking care of an infant is very demanding, right? 24 hours. You know, if an infant is in distress, you don't scold them, you don't reason with them, you don't discipline them, you know, you meet their distress. No matter what you're doing, you have to be willing, so attuned to someone else's needs that you're willing to drop what you're doing and meet their distress. That takes a certain character. You also have to be very attuned to nonverbal communication. The infant's not talking yet. For 2 years, he's not talking. So you have to be very attuned to body language and nonverbal communication. And you have to be very attuned to threats in the environment. This is something I've really noticed with a difference between fathers and mothers. Fathers are not usually as attuned to some danger in the environment that's facing their children. Mothers develop a very finely tuned, you know, antenna. And what we have to insist on is that these are all strengths. It's one set of strengths versus another set of strengths. Not just, well, men are strong and women are weak, which is what you do hear a lot. No, men are physically stronger. Women have their own psychological strengths. And so that would kind of forestall people who are just, you know, who are hesitant about acknowledging any differences, is that we say, no, they're both their own unique forms of strength.
I like how you're phrasing it too, in such as they're both positive qualities. And I like that you said they just need to be used in a biblical manner, because I do see in culture a lot taking the unique attributes of men, the unique attributes of women, and finding ways to say, oh, well, that's negative, or no, that one's better than the other one. Like, it happens all the time. So I really like you're saying, no, well, they're both equally valuable. Just because they're different doesn't make them less valuable.
It kind of reminds me of an analogy I heard about men and women, where women were created to cultivate, right? And we were created to grow and nurture, and then men supposed to protect that. So we both have two different jobs. We each kind of harmonize with the other, where one is growing and the other is protecting what is growing.
Yes, I mean, there's a reason women are physically smaller and physically weaker. And that men, like you said, God created men to be physically stronger in order to, shall I use the three P's again? Provide, protect, and procreate, you know, raise a family. So, yeah, I totally agree with you that it's not that there's not a lot of overlap. You know, we don't want to overstress the differences, because men and women are certainly more alike than they are different. And so, you know, we're both made in the image of God. We both share a common humanity. And that's sort of the starting point. But we shouldn't denigrate the differences. You know, we should appreciate and value them and cherish them and protect them.
And that kind of leads into the question kind of about pronouns and what we're supposed to be doing with that.
100%. We were wondering, how should Christians respond to somebody who demands that we use their preferred pronouns?
Yeah, I like to tell people to go read Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, which is, you know, it was a wonderful expose of the Soviet prison system. What he said was, the worst part about totalitarianism wasn't the physical abuse, the, you know, imprisoning innocent people, torturing them in prison, you know, working them to death in work camps. I mean, there's a lot that was terrible about totalitarianism. But you know what he said was the worst part? The lie. Having to pretend to believe and agree with the lie. So you had to pretend that you agreed with the regime, even though you didn't. The reason that's a problem is because if you are forced to affirm or follow an ideology that you know is wrong or false, that creates an internal conflict within you.
Yeah.
And eventually it damages your own sense of integrity. And so this is what's at stake with, you know, insisting that somebody uses a pronouns that they think are not true. In other words, if you're a male who says, please call me she, and you have to say, that's not true. And if there's an insistence that you do, you see, it's always couched in terms of compassion for the transgender person. What about compassion for the person who's being asked to lie? And yeah. The way that damages their own internal sense of self and their own internal integrity. It was, by the way, I told you I was just in Vienna. So when I was in Vienna, I met a man who was from East Germany, and his father was a Lutheran pastor. And he put this better than anyone else I've ever heard. He said, when you're living under a regime that is forcing you to give, you know, verbal agreement with the regime and comply with it, with your behavior, he talked about the internal conflict that causes, cognitive dissonance, right?
Yeah.
And then he said, you learn to hate yourself. You hate yourself because you're living out something that you believe is false. You're being forced to be false to your own beliefs, your own convictions. And he said, you start to hate yourself. It tears you down inside and makes you easier to manipulate.
Oh, man.
So that's why they insist on it. You've seen those pictures where, Hitler parades, where everyone had to do the Hitler salute, yeah. for example. They don't care if you believe it or not. They know that if you go along with it, you would become more manipulative. You will become more manipulable because it tears down your inner sense of self. Mm-hmm. So it's a much bigger deal than just, being nice to somebody. I did have that question asked me recently at a conference. Well, shouldn't we just be, compassionate and nice and, go along with the pronouns as a temporary thing?
Right.
Well, it's not temporary. It has far-reaching impact on the people who, if they are forced or compelled to go along with something that they believe is false.
Yeah.
Like the final thing, I thought that was his final word, that it makes you more manipulable. I thought that was a great insight.
Yeah. Well, because that's what cognitive dissonance does too, right? Is it's your brain can't connect the two. And so something has to shift, fix that dissonance. So.
Yeah. Good insight.
It is so fascinating to me because I never had considered the person who was forced into that situation and forced to repeat a lie to somebody else to affirm them, what it would do to them. It's always based on how the person who is receiving that lie feels and how it would build them up. Though we all know at the end of the day, a lie, even if it sounds good in the moment, it's going to eventually come down. And
yeah, the other thing is listen to detransitioners. There are so many people now who are detransitioning. And I love following them because they can tell us what it was really like to be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what they all say? I wish people had not gone along with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish they had not used my pronouns. I wish they had not changed my name. I wish they had not gone along with the social transition. And most of all, of course, I wish they had not gone along with all the medical interventions, puberty blockers, hormones, and surgery.
100%.
Listen to the detransitioners. They'll tell you, we wish people hadn't gone along with it. We wish people had stood up, stood on their principles. We're not being compassionate, it turns out, that they themselves wish that we'd held them to a higher standard instead of just, capitulating, to their current feelings.
Yeah,
that's actually really fascinating because today, the day we're recording this, is actually the drop date for our podcast that we had on three detransitioners who told their stories.
Mm-hmm. And so they round table.
Yeah, they all agree where it. They wish that somebody would have cared for them enough to tell the truth.
I'm going to have to go back and listen to that one.
It's coming out as soon as we're finished recording.
Great.
It was a fascinating conversation.
Based off of that, I want to ask our final question. As young adults, we're in our 20s, we have listeners that are in their teens. How can we be there for our friends without compromising our beliefs, without becoming more manipulable by affirming a lie to them? How do we be there for our friends who are struggling with gender dysphoria? What would your advice be to us?
One of the most surprising things is that the core of this debate is our view of the body. In other words, transgender activists argue explicitly that your gender identity has nothing to do with your body, with your biological sex. A BBC documentary puts it this way: at the heart of the debate is the idea that your mind can be at war with your body.
Mm-hmm.
And in that war, of course, it's the mind that wins. or there was another BBC program for teenagers, and it showed a young girl who identified as non-binary. And she said, it doesn't matter what meat skeleton you've been born in. It's your feelings that count. Mm. So the body has been demoted to a meat skeleton. And then since I work at a university, I have to read what the academics say. And the first book to come out defending transgenderism was a Princeton University professor. And here's what she said, literally. She said, what the physical body tells us is nothing. It has no meaning at all. And I think we have to help young people realize when they feel gender distress, they're not just debating whether I should go with my feelings or not, because that's how it seems to them at the moment, right? Teenagers don't have a huge, sense of the world out there. They're so focused on their feelings. But they're not just going with their feelings. They are adopting a worldview. It's a worldview that says there's this junction, this disconnect. By the way, that's what the Princeton University professor also said. She said it involves self-alienation, self-disconnect, self-disjunction. She used all this language.
Yeah, I feel like those are the same words used to describe like mental illnesses. Like, I think there's literally one that is described using those terms.
Self-alienation and disintegration, the separation of your body and your mind or your feelings. It is, I believe, an unhealthy way to live. It's an unhealthy worldview. So the worldview is saying, basically, that you have a body that's not part of your authentic self. You know, who cares? It's irrelevant. It's insignificant. And all that matters is your mind and feelings. Well, first of all, that's a very low view of the body that denigrates the body. It says, like that Princeton University professor, the body has no meaning at all. And that message is getting down to kindergartners today. Your body has no meaning. And, the body is an important part of our identity. And so that means an important part of ourself is being denigrated and downgraded and told it's meaningless and irrelevant. There was a news story not long ago about a first grader who came home from school and said, Mommy, my teacher said, just because you have boy parts doesn't mean you're a boy. Just because you have girl parts doesn't mean you're a girl. Oh. And she literally said to her mother, please take me to a doctor so we can find out what I am. And the reason it was in the news is that the parents were suing the school for emotional distress. First graders are being taught your body parts have nothing to do with your identity. They give you no message, to who you are. They give you certainly no moral message of how you should live. We have to help people to see that Christianity actually has a much higher view of the body, because it says the body is a creation of God. It's the body is not a product of mindless material forces, evolutionary forces. It's an intentional creation of a loving creator, and therefore has value and dignity and significance. It's not irrelevant. It's not insignificant. It has enormous significance. People don't think that Christianity has high view of the body because traditionally we've had kind of a sacred secular split, where Christians kind of acted like, well, this world doesn't really matter. It's a spiritual world that really matters. We've got to get past that, because today it's the secular world that is saying your body doesn't matter. Your body has no meaning. Your body is not important. And it's actually the Christian view that said, whoa, wait a minute. It's part of God's creation. It does have value. This is the message for young people. We have a very positive message that in addressing issues, all the cutting edge issues, from abortion, homosexuality, transgenderism, all of them involve in some way the body. And it's Christianity today that has a much higher view of the body than any other religion or philosophy.
Wow.
And so, again, it gives us the opportunity to have a very positive approach when we're talking to our friends and family members on these issues.
And that's so necessary, because I think so often the approach is just negative, negative. So having something positive, I think, will be a lot more effective, which is really neat. So we really appreciate that fun question. We know that you love classical music. So what would your top recommendations be for someone who has never listened to classical music before?
So what I used with my children when I was homeschooling was a set of tapes. Well, now they're CDs. The set was called An Introduction to the Classics, and each individual one was called The Story of Bach in Words and Music, or The Story of Beethoven in Words and Music, The Story of Mozart in Words and Music. And what it was the story of the composer's life interspersed with excerpts from his music. And I have to tell you, as a music major in college, right, playing the violin, I paid my way through college on music scholarships. And I still learned more about the composers with this set. And the reason for that is when you get excerpts from music over his whole lifetime, you don't just learn individual pieces. You know, in school, I just learned individual pieces. When you get sections from the whole lifetime, you get their overall style, their personality. And my children would get to say, oh, well, that's a Bach, you know, or that's a Mozart. They recognize the overall style of the different composers. And this set is still available on Amazon, actually not as a set. I think you have to buy the individual CDs now. And a lot of homeschooling curricula still use them. I did look it up before going on air today so I could say that confidently. And I found a couple of different homeschool curricula that use it. And so even though it's designed for younger children, you know, like I say, I was a music major and I still learned a lot from it. And then for older people, there is another set, another instructional videos. It's from a company called The Teaching Company, and it's called the Great Courses Series. And a lot of homeschoolers use that with their high schoolers. I've listened to all of those, too, all of them. They have about 10, I think, that are on individual composers. You learn something about who they are. And by the way, you asked, you know, for people who've never really been exposed to classical music, that's the way to do it. Learn about the composer as a person, you know, because music is abstract. So if you learn about the person, their personality, what happened to them in their life, the things that they did in their life, and then you kind of learn the music with that and how it reflects them as a personality, I think that makes it much more approachable. So the Great Courses Series, yes.
I said I 100% agree.
That's pretty awesome.
Yes. I mean, all of us are more drawn in by people, by personalities. And so if you learn about the composer as a personality, then it becomes easier to understand and appreciate their music.
That sounds like such a cool CD set. I might have to look that up just to see if I can listen to it, because that sounds totally awesome.
Yeah, I remember when I was learning Beethoven for classical piano, and I just did not like it at all. But then I was tasked with reading a biography of him. Once I learned his story, I actually was able to be much more appreciative of his music and what I was playing because, well, it reflected different periods of his life. I really enjoyed playing it and being part of that story then.
Yeah, that's what I found as well. I mean, I speaking for myself, but also for my students, you know, when they get to know the composer as an individual, and their quirks, their personality, you know, the problems they faced. Beethoven faced a lot of problems when he was growing up. And so you become more sympathetic.
100%.
What about operas? What would your go-to opera be?
Well, opera is a tough one because I think most people don't like opera. And
no,
they don't understand it. They don't like it. And I didn't like it. And I'll tell you what got me into opera was the series I just mentioned, the Great Courses Series. I was listening to the history of music for writing my book, Saving Leonardo. It was part of my research. I had to know music history because, right?
That's awesome.
Saving Leonardo is on sort of the history of the interaction between philosophy and the arts, you know, how ideas are reflected in the arts. And so, of course, I had to bone up on my music history. But in one of their courses, they have a huge introductory course, the Great Courses Series. And I think it's just called How to Appreciate Great Music, something like that. And they had two classes on opera. And I said, oh, once you explain it to me, opera's kind of cool. I like this. And so then I went and I bought their series called How to Listen to Great Opera. I started understanding it better and liking it more. And I was so enthusiastic that then I bought a whole course on operas of Verdi and a whole course on the operas of Mozart. I think that's all the ones they have on opera. And you asked, how can you kind of introduce someone to opera? Well, first of all, that's one way to do it. It's like anything. The more you understand it, the more you like it. You know, if you don't understand football strategy, you don't like football.
Right.
But once you understand the strategy and you know what it means when they say fourth and down or something like that, then you start to appreciate. And so just getting these Great Courses Series is a good start. And then my second tip is this. During the pandemic, the Metropolitan Opera Company in New York City offered their operas free. That was one of the ways that they were going to help people during the pandemic, is that when you're stuck at home, you can listen to free operas. And here's what makes it distinctive, though. Not a, you know, it's a world-class opera company, but what made it distinctive is that they have, in the last, I don't know how many years, I would guess maybe at most the last decade, they've been doing HDTV. Usually you run an opera several nights, right? And then one night they bring in the cameras, you get close-ups. One reason people have not liked opera in the past is you can't see them. You don't see any, you don't really see their facial expressions. And so opera singers were not great actors. They just sort of stood up there in a stiff way, you know, put their hands out. And it's very stiff. That there was not a lot of acting. Well, you can't do that with HDTV. The singers have had to become much better actors because that TV zooms right in on your face and catches every lift of the eyebrow, right? And so it's great. They have, in fact, become much better actors, which means they're, you know, they're expressing the storyline much more dramatically. You can follow what's happening. You can get to know the characters much better. And so today, if you want to follow up, make sure you get HDTV. Don't get the older ones. Make sure you only get the HDTV version. It's only $4.99. That's less than going to a movie. So stay home, get out the popcorn, and watch an opera instead of going out to a movie.
That's awesome. I know we studied opera in a music appreciation class I took, and being able to see it close up when they were decent actors definitely made it far more engaging because you can appreciate how hard it is to do the singing, and then you can also appreciate the story.
Yeah, I just had a speaking tour in Europe, and so as long as I was in Vienna, of course I went to the opera. And you know what? It was a big disappointment.
Oh, that's so amazing.
I mean, it's supposed to be one of the best in the world, right? The Vienna State Opera.
Yeah.
But in a regular auditorium, it's just like the olden times where you can't see their faces. You can't see expressions. They have to make sort of grand gestures because it's, you know, you're so far away. And so it's kind of stiff. And I thought, oh my goodness, I can go home and watch the Met instead. And have a much better experience.
Oh, man.
Well, at least you were able to experience an opera live in Vienna, though. That's a huge feather in your cap.
Yeah.
Culturally speaking, it was an experience.
So as we're wrapping up, just what advice would you want to give to young adults? Something that you heard when you were younger that you wish you'd heard when you were younger?
Well, can I give one more example on the body? Because that's 100%. Such an important point. And sometimes an example can highlight it. So one of the examples I tell in my book, Love Thy Body, is a young woman who lived as a lesbian for many years and then became a Christian and today is married to a man. You have to say that. To a man. And has two children. And she wrote an article about it. And she said, the turning point came when I came to trust that God had made me female for a reason. Mm. And I wanted to honor my body by living in accord with the Creator's design.
Wow.
That's so neat.
Exactly. That's perfect. Practice that until you can say it. So when I give my how-to at the end of my talk, I will start with that one. Honor my body by living in accord with the Creator's design, you know, or live in harmony with your biological sex. Respect your biological sex. Live in tune with who God made you to be. Mm. We almost have to practice this language because, like you said, we're so used to saying it's wrong, it's a sin, don't do it, and implying, and there's something wrong with you. And I've had a lot of students, I've watched them make this, you know, change. They start with the negative language, and I have a course on Love Thy Body. Over the course of the semester, they gradually learn to change their language. It's not easy. And so that's why I wanted to reinforce that. Even non-Christians recognize it. Right after my book came out, a young woman detransitioned. You may know her if you've been looking at detransitioners. She did an interview. She had lived as a trans boy for 3 years. Mm-hmm. She had transitioned at age 11. Detransitioned at age 14.
Wow.
And she said in this interview, the turning point came when I realized it's not conversion therapy to learn to love your body.
Wow.
See, even secular people are recognizing the core of this debate is our treatment of the body. Do we love the body? Do we treat it as valuable and significant?
Yeah.
So I thought maybe those two examples would help, you know, help flesh it out.
Yeah, it does.
The message, the positive message of respect your body.
It does. And it is so helpful too, because especially young adults and teenagers, they, as everything's changing, you know, it's already hard mm-hmm. to know whether or not you can love your body. And then you add in social media and everything today, and there's so many conflicting negative narratives and stories just going through that. I think having something positive, and something positive that's grounded in biblical fact and just in, you know, in the way God created the world, is so, so amazing. So thank you so, so much, Nancy. I can't tell you how much we enjoyed this conversation. How can people connect with you, and where can they purchase a copy of The Toxic War on Masculinity?
Where can they find Love Thy Body?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So my publisher was kind enough to redesign my website, so it's bright and colorful now.
Yay.
And so you should come to my website, Nancy. NancyPiercy.com. Don't forget the extra E, P-E-A-R-C-E-Y. NancyPiercy.com. And yes, you can browse my other books there. You can read the endorsements. You know, you can leave a message. I really enjoy it when I hear from people. I don't always have time to respond, but I really enjoy reading comments from people who come to the website. So yeah, obviously you can buy the books on Amazon or Christian Book, wherever you like to shop. But you can come over and browse them to start with on the website, NancyPiercy.com. So come on over and say hello.
Awesome. And we'll put a link to that in the description of our podcast too, so people can access it easy. Thank you so much. We really, really enjoyed this conversation, and we feel so blessed to be able to get to speak with you.
I really enjoyed it. And it's just so good to see you guys again. I remember our conversations when I was IFI in Illinois yes. Family Institute. It was a great conference, and I really appreciated getting to meet you there.
Truly, and it was wonderful hearing your presentations. Really, really, really inspiring and very educational.
It really was, yeah.
Oh, thank you.